Welcome back. If you're joining us right now, you are stepping into the second installment of our three-part deep dive into the wildly unconventional journey of how Taras Wolff became an architect.
And honestly, unconventional is putting it mildly at this point.
Oh, absolutely. Today, we're pulling from this massive stack of sources again, the biographical notes, his architectural manifestos, those hours of personal interviews. And today's deep dive is officially titled The Art of Being Lost and Found.
Right, because today our mission is to explore the ultimate detour. We're looking at how Taras used this rebellious creativity and just pure, unfiltered imagination to carve a totally unique path completely outside the traditional system.
Yeah, if you thought part one was an interesting ride, I mean, buckle up, because the meticulous blueprint we discussed last time is about to be thrown out the window, literally set on fire.
Quite literally, yes.
But before we get to the ashes of that blueprint, we really need to do a rapid-fire recap of part one just to get everyone up to speed.
We do.
Seriously, I highly recommend you go back and listen to part one if you haven't already. It has so many amazing stories and pearls of wisdom about creativity that you really don't want to miss. But for the sake of the timeline, let's hit the key beats. We have a strict 5-minute limit for this recap, so let's get moving.
Understood. Okay, so we started with Taras growing up, isolated in Thailand as a half-child in the 1970s. No siblings, no peers around, so he retreated inward.
Right.
He relied on his boundless imagination to build his own miniature worlds using paper, tape, glue, and a 0.1-millimeter Rotring drafting pen.
He was basically a creative ghost in those early classrooms.
Exactly. Daydreaming his way into terrible grades, which ultimately got him shipped off to boarding school at the United World College in Singapore.
And that is where he met Michael Liu. This was the great rivalry.
Oh, the ultimate rivalry. Yeah. In their craft design and technology class, Michael Liu, this highly charismatic, Bruce Lee-esque cool kid, pushed Taras to absolute extreme creative limits. They just fiercely egged each other on to top marks, which is what forged Taras's incredible design portfolio.
But then he faced a massive problem, algebra.
His absolute nemesis.
Right. His math grades simply weren't high enough for the prestigious architecture program at the University of Melbourne. So what does he do? He bypasses the entire grading system.
He just ignores it.
He shows up in Melbourne, effectively kicks down the door with his portfolio, and secures a historic 93rd spot in a program that only had 92 places. He got in purely on his creative merit. He outran the equations.
Which is just wild. And he excelled. He became the star student, submitting multiple versions of his assignments in full color just for the fun of it.
It's just showing off, really.
He was totally unstoppable until his third year when he received the fateful B grade.
Just a single B.
Just one. But instead of fighting the professor or spiraling, he viewed it as this cosmic sign that his life had become completely unbalanced.
Yeah.
He went to the movies, watched Strictly Ballroom, and decided to walk into a local dance studio to find some equilibrium.
Which is exactly where part one ended, with Taras stepping onto the polished wood of the dance studio, thinking he was just picking up a casual hobby. He had absolutely no idea that it was about to turn his meticulously planned world upside down.
Boom. Nailed the recap under 5 minutes. But again, go listen to part one.
Now, let's unpack this next chapter, because things take a very sharp turn.
Yep.
Taras finishes his undergraduate degree. He's been working his tail off, not just in the university studios, but on actual construction sites with his father's property development firm back in Thailand.
Which is a huge detail.
Huge. So naturally, he applies for an industry experience exemption before starting his master's.
Right, because the standard progression required a mandatory period of practical work experience before postgraduate studies.
Taras assumes he's a shoo-in for this exemption. He has real-world muddy boots experience on actual building sites. Plus, he has a personal relationship with the new dean of the faculty, Haig Beck.
Dean Beck frequently used Taras' designs as prime examples to exhibit. They had a real rapport. So Taras walks in, requests the exemption, and Dean Haig Beck flatly denies it.
Just shuts it down.
He insists that a year away from the academic environment would be, quote, good for him. Let's pause here because I really got to ask, was this just a standard bureaucratic hurdle or was there something deeper going on?
I mean, it felt incredibly patronizing to Taras. You have to understand the psychology of a highly driven, creative young man who has basically spent his entire life outsmarting rigid systems.
Yeah, he's always found a loophole.
Exactly. So when the institution you've bent over backward for the institution that literally created a special spot for you and parades your work around suddenly puts up a brick wall based on a technicality, the whiplash is intense.
Oh, I bet.
Taras realizes in that moment that institutional validation is totally fickle. The rules apply when they want them to apply, and exceptions are made only when it suits the gatekeepers.
So his reaction is born out of this deep sense of betrayal. He thinks, if I'm not allowed to get this exemption with all my actual literal construction experience, who on earth is this clause even for?
It fuels a totally new kind of fire within him. He decides that if the academic path is blocked by arbitrary gatekeeping, he's going to build a career so substantial on his own that the missing master's degree won't even matter.
So he starts by getting a job at a prestigious architectural firm in Melbourne. But he's young, so they tell him to basically sit quietly, wait his turn, and earn his place.
Standard industry practice, really.
Yeah, doing basic grunt work while knowing he is capable of complex, visionary design. And he just hits a wall. He quits the prestigious firm job. He walks away from the industry completely. He turns professional in dance. And then he does the unthinkable.
The big moment.
He burns his University of Melbourne degree, literally sets it on fire.
It is an incredibly potent image.
I gotta push back on this a little bit, though. Imagine holding that degree. You've battled childhood isolation. You moved to a new country. You fought the university gatekeepers to secure that 93rd spot. And you finally hold the paper in your hands, and your response to a bureaucratic hurdle is to set it on fire.
Right.
It's just incredibly dramatic. Was this just youthful hubris, or was there a deeper calculation there?
It's easy to view it as pure hubris, sure, but it's actually a profound psychological severance. Watching that piece of paper turn to ash wasn't just about destroying a document. It was a physical manifestation of his frustration.
Like a ritual.
Exactly. He was making a declaration of independence. He was telling the world, and more importantly himself, that no piece of paper would ever be tied to his self-worth or his creative output again. He refused to let an institution dictate his value.
It is the ultimate slap in the face to the establishment. So he pivots entirely to the dance floor.
Mm.
But he doesn't enter the professional dance world quietly. He brings this art man creativity with him. He isn't just executing steps. He's inventing them.
He treats choreography exactly like he treated his architecture assignments. He absolutely refused to be contained by a basic brief.
Right.
In the rigid, highly structured world of ballroom and Latin dance, there are strict expectations of how you move, how you look, and how you behave. Taras focused on peak performance and theatrical creativity. He was genuinely original.
Wildly original is an understatement based on these sources. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is out there sliding through the ladies' legs, jumping completely over their heads. And keep in mind the aesthetic of this world. Traditional ballroom and Latin dance is all about the pageantry, the sequins, the extravagant outfits, the slicked back hair.
Heavily lacquered hair.
Yes. And here comes Taras, refusing to cut off his long ponytail, wearing plain black t-shirts instead of the bedazzled costumes.
Yeah.
He just didn't care to conform because fundamentally he was dancing for himself.
He had zero reverence for their traditions because he was an outsider. He wasn't raised in the ballroom ecosystem, so he didn't share their implicit biases about what was quote-unquote proper. And honestly, my favorite detail from the sources is how he incorporated vocal sound effects into his routines.
Oh, the kung fu noises?
Yeah.
I'm laughing just picturing this scenario. He isn't out there doing high-pitched screeches, but he's adding these sharp swooshes and grunts to perfectly match the energy of the step he's executing.
So theatrical.
It was just enough to catch the attention of the judges as he glides past them on the floor.
It's brilliant, really. It forces the judges to look at him. In a sea of competitors plastering on fake, rigid smiles, here's a guy treating the dance floor like a martial arts cinematic sequence. But he took it even further when it came to provocation.
Oh, he really did.
If there was a judge on the panel he particularly disliked, he would use those vocals as a weapon.
Yes. The sources say he would glide right past a judge he didn't care for and cheekily yell through his teeth, "You bitch."
Just incredible audacity.
Imagine being that judge. You are sitting there with your clipboard, expecting total deference from these competitors, and this guy with a ponytail and a black t-shirt swooshes past and insults you. The judges would look at him in shock, thinking, did that dancer just say something obscene to me?
They wouldn't even be sure they heard it right.
Exactly. And Taras is just smiling cheekily straight at them as he dances away.
It's pure psychological warfare. He's acting as a spanner in the works for the establishment. He understood that to break new ground, you have to genuinely not care what the gatekeepers think. You have to do what most people simply wish they could do without their fear of judgment.
Speaking of psychological warfare, we have got to talk about the silver tray incident.
Oh, the ultimate disruption of ballroom etiquette.
So in professional dance competitions, there's this unwritten rule. No one gets a drink in between dances. It simply isn't done.
Right. It's a massive faux pas.
If you need water during that tiny 20-second break between heats, it shows you have poor physical conditioning. It's viewed as a visible weakness. Most dancers would rather pass out from dehydration than let the judges see them take a sip of water.
Taras looks at this rule, and his architectural, problem-solving mind flips it completely on its head. He realizes that sneaking a drink from a plastic bottle would look desperate. But what if he made the act of drinking look royal?
So instead of scurrying off the floor to grab a water bottle, he orchestrates a full spectacle. He organizes for a friend to walk right onto the competition floor during that brief 20-second break, carrying their drinks beautifully presented on a literal silver tray.
It is a masterpiece of projection. He's not just hydrating. He's projecting complete, absurd dominance. The judges are staring in shock at the audacity. The other competitors, who are parched, sweating, and exhausted, are just furious because they secretly wish they could have a drink too.
I am amazed by this level of petty genius. He's standing there on the polished wood, sipping from a silver tray, basically telling everyone in the room, I'm not just keeping up with the pace, I am completely in control of this entire environment.
Exactly.
The establishment never forgot it, and according to the sources, they never really forgave him for it either.
Which brings us to the harsh reality of Chapter 6. The dance establishment in Melbourne at that time did not like him very much. They felt he hadn't paid his dues. They felt he had turned professional way too early, bypassing the amateur ranks where you were supposed to learn compliance.
You got to fall in line first.
Right. So all his creative stunts were suddenly being judged by a highly critical, deeply entrenched mindset.
He went from being a rebel without a cause to realizing he was a very small fish in a very big, very judgmental pond. And making a living as a slightly ostracized, budding professional dancer is incredibly hard.
The ashes of his degree had barely settled, and suddenly the romanticized vision of his new artistic life collided with the stark reality of paying the bills. He had to get scrappy. He had to build a completely new economy for himself.
And the relentless daily juggle he pulls off is exhausting just to read about. I mean, let me lay out this schedule for you. Every single morning, rigorous, physically punishing dance training, pushing his body to the limits to compete at a professional level.
Which takes hours.
Hours. And the rest of the daylight hours. He's hunting for original vintage Star Wars toys from the 1970s and 80s.
We really need to contextualize the vintage toy market at this specific time. This was a highly profitable side hustle because George Lucas had just announced the new prequel movies.
The hype was unreal.
The cultural nostalgia for Star Wars was exploding, and the value of those original figurines and plastic spaceships was skyrocketing. Taras recognized the arbitrage opportunity.
But the irony is where he went to find them. He goes right back to the University of Melbourne campus, his old turf. He is walking the exact same halls he used to navigate as an architecture student, but this time he's putting up posters promising hard cash for old plastic toys.
The profound sense of liberation he felt doing that cannot be overstated. He's walking past the studios where his old classmates and peers are tucked away, their heads buried in complex drafting work, stressing over arbitrary deadlines set by the very professors who denied his exemption.
Right.
They are chained to their desks, following the predictable straight path laid out by the institution, while he's out there trading Boba Fett figures.
I gotta play devil's advocate here, though.
Yeah.
Isn't there a huge risk of him just completely derailing? How does selling plastic spaceships do anything but distract him from his actual talent? He has this incredible design mind, and he's spending his afternoons haggling over action figures.
It looks like a distraction, but it's actually an immersion in raw, unfiltered commerce. He is learning the mechanics of business. Supply, demand, negotiation, and margin, all without the safety net of an architectural firm.
So it's a real-world MBA.
Exactly. He felt unequivocally free. He was surviving, learning how to generate capital on his own terms and answering to absolutely no one. That entrepreneurial muscle is exactly what he would need later to run his own firm.
Okay, fair point.
Yeah.
He was the master of his own time. But the hustle didn't stop when the sun went down. Deep into the night, he drew upon his old identity as the art man. He would stand in front of a canvas, painting and sculpting, creating artworks to sell in local galleries just to bridge the financial gap.
And the weekends offered zero rest. Cleaning his Star Wars stock or standing at local collector fairs selling toys to enthusiasts.
It never ends.
Late into the early morning hours, he would be at a fax machine or making exorbitant long-distance overseas phone calls to the UK and the US to get an edge on his toy stock.
It is a crazy, chaotic life. But here is the critical detail from the sources. Despite burning the degree, the architect within him was still in hiding, quietly working. He was still taking on freelance design work, mostly doing favors and designing real buildings for family and friends for free.
Let's pause on the legalities here, because the architectural world is highly gatekept. You cannot just hang a shingle that says architect without the degree and the board registration. It's illegal.
Oh, definitely.
If he charged for these designs and published them, he would have been pulled right back into the bureaucratic crosshairs of the industry he just set fire to.
So he does it for free to stay off the radar. But he wasn't churning out average work for these favors. The sources emphasize that he was designing cutting-edge, highly detailed work.
He was relying on timeless design ideas and strict proportions that he actually still uses in his studio today. What's fascinating about this detail is how his conscious mind was fiercely determined to avoid the establishment, but his subconscious was quietly laying the permanent foundations for his architectural legacy.
He just couldn't turn that part of his brain off.
Right. He was keeping the design engine running purely for the love of the craft, stripped of all academic pressure.
So Taras is surviving. He's independent, but he is exhausted. He has built this fragile, chaotic, but entirely independent ecosystem in Melbourne. He's his own boss. But just as he's finding his footing in this bizarre toy and dance economy, an external force pulls him back. Let's talk about the phone call from Thailand.
His father calls. The family's property development business is failing rapidly, and his father really needs Taras to come back to Thailand and help run things.
Taras is initially reluctant to give up his hard-won independence, but he sees a strategic opportunity. He can leverage his dual nationality and dance for Thailand. He liked the idea of leaving the hypercritical Melbourne scene and becoming a big fish in a smaller pond.
He relocates to Bangkok, and the strategy works perfectly. He and his partner completely dominate the local scene. They claim the number one spot in the country and become the undefeated champions of Southeast Asia. He is finally riding high. He has the status and the financial backing.
And riding this massive wave of success, he decides to build a dance school by the river.
This is a profound milestone in his architectural journey. It is his very first building executed purely for himself.
Wow.
He designs it to be completely minimalist. It felt more like an exclusive art gallery where the dancers themselves were the kinetic art. He is finally fusing his two worlds, design and dance, into a single physical space.
I really want to unpack his inspiration here because we have to talk about Paul Green. Throughout Taras' life, there are very few people he actually looks up to for inspiration. Back at the UWC boarding school in Singapore, it was his rival, Michael Liu. In the dance world, it's the Australian champion, Paul Green.
Paul Green was the absolute pinnacle of ballroom performance for Taras. Before this point, Taras would spend his nights obsessively studying VHS tapes of Paul, breaking everything down in slow motion, analyzing every shift in weight, every posture, every flick of the wrist.
But studying a flickering low-resolution TV screen is fundamentally two-dimensional. When Taras finally sees Paul Green live on the competition floor, it is a revelation. The sources describe it as a sensory overload. The sheer power, the effortless charisma, the way Paul commanded the air around him. Taras realizes that if improving his foundational technique gets him even a fraction closer to that incredible energy, he's willing to do the grueling work.
He finds his North Star.
Right. He is no longer just a rebel trying to annoy the judges with kung fu noises. He has a target.
This is where Paul's coaches, Helen and Robert Ritchie, step into the narrative. They were formidable past champions, and they had seen all of Taras' crazy, provocative stunts. Helen understood exactly what he was doing. She saw through the rebellion and recognized a rough diamond.
She knew he had it.
She told him his sheer energy and his courage to be original were precious commodities in a world of clones.
She gives him this incredible piece of advice.
Mm-hmm.
She looks at him and says, "The world doesn't need another Paul Green. It needs a Taras." She tells him that if he wants to be Paul, he cannot just mimic his style. He has to refine his technique to project exactly who Taras is.
So Taras is training with intense discipline, aiming straight for Paul Green's level. But just around the time Taras moves to Bangkok and becomes a champion in Southeast Asia, Paul retires from professional competition.
And Taras is crushed. Not just because he won't get the chance to compete against him directly, but because he lost his primary source of inspiration. In a sea of competitors who were just following the latest fads, Paul was a true innovator. Paul carried a commanding, fiercely masculine presence on the floor that gave Taras a clear template for the kind of performer and man he wanted to be.
The void left by his retirement is massive.
But here is where Taras' new status as the highest paid dancer in Southeast Asia comes into play. He finally has the financial means to solve the problem. He flies Paul Green into Thailand to teach him at his Riverside school for weeks at a time.
He just buys his mentor's time.
It's such a pragmatic, Taras-esque solution.
Yeah.
And all that intensive one-on-one time in the tropical heat of Bangkok forges a profoundly strong bond between them. They transition from idol and student to best friends. They become brothers.
It raises a beautiful, poetic parallel, actually. In a parallel universe, Taras' relationship with Paul Green perfectly mirrors what could have been with Michael Liu had Michael chosen to become an architect.
Oh, wow. Never thought about that.
Right. Just as Paul and Taras found a profound brotherhood through their shared passion and initial rivalry in dance, Michael and Taras might have eventually moved past their fierce classroom competition to become lifelong peers in design. Paul Green basically became the lifelong peer that Michael Liu could have been.
That is a brilliant connection. Really. But unfortunately, while life inside his meditative gallery-like dance school is peaceful and prosperous, the moment he steps outside those doors, he's living a nightmare.
We have to factor in the immense cultural and economic weight here. This is during the Asian financial crisis. His father's property empire is collapsing.
And the cultural implications of that are huge.
Massive. In a traditional Chinese family dynamic, the patriarch's success is deeply intertwined with the family's identity. His father isn't just losing money, he's losing face on a massive scale. Taras is stepping into an environment where compromise is seen as weakness, and his father is doubling down out of pride.
Taras is used to navigating around obstacles with charm, creativity, or sheer force of will, like bypassing the university faculty or outsmarting dance judges. But he suddenly finds himself in a rigid, high-stakes standoff where none of his usual tools work.
He's going head-to-head with his incredibly proud father, who leaves no room for an amicable compromise. The burden of filial piety clashes directly with Taras' need for independence and rational business solutions. The tension is totally toxic.
The daily reality of this collapsing empire is destroying him. He realizes that simply leaving it all behind is the only way for his soul to escape the nightmare. The money and the championship titles in Bangkok aren't worth the psychological toll, so he makes the drastic decision to flee back to Australia.
Which brings us to Chapter 7. Taras returns to Melbourne, completely uncertain of his future. And shortly after he arrives, he gets devastating news from Thailand. His beautiful, minimalist dance school by the river in Bangkok, his very first solo architectural achievement, has been completely demolished.
Oh, man. The jarring shock of this transition is staggering. Think about the whiplash here. He goes from being the wealthy, celebrated champion of Southeast Asia, living in the tropical heat, commanding respect, designing his own spaces, to returning to a freezing Melbourne winter with absolutely nothing. He is totally anonymous again. He hits rock bottom.
And we mean rock bottom literally. For 3 brutal months during the Melbourne winter, he sleeps on a friend's freezing balcony because it is the cheapest accommodation he can find.
Waking up shivering on a concrete balcony after being a champion. I mean, the ego hit must have been massive. It would be so easy to succumb to bitterness. Most people would be asking, how on earth did I end up right back at square one? Was this whole detour a mistake?
But what's remarkable is that he brings back no sense of regret. He doesn't view his life as a linear ladder where he just fell off the top rung. He views his life as a tree with branches growing in all directions. He's simply waiting to see which branch will sprout leaves first.
That philosophical resilience is what keeps him from spiraling.
Very slice.
That is an incredible mindset. So he's back, he hustles, he eventually gets a roof over his head, and then an accidental return to campus happens. A friend from his university days asks for his help. She has gone back to complete her master's in architecture, and she needs help building a physical model.
As he helps her cut and glue the model together, he realizes that the academic process is still exactly the same. It's full of the same tedious artificial assignments that drove him away in the first place.
Nothing changed.
Nothing. She finds it exhausting, too. So they make a pact. They decide to set up a small, unregistered practice together. They call it Wolf Designs and start taking on small, odd jobs.
And right around this time, a deeply ironic twist of fate occurs. Taras is asked by a fellow teacher to fill in for a dance class for a week. Taras asks, "Where's the gig?" And the guy says, "The University of Melbourne."
The irony is so rich.
I can just hear Taras laughing at the universe.
Mm-hmm.
He returns to the very campus where he burned his degree. but he returns not as a student of architecture begging for an exemption, but as a teacher of rhythm.
Coming in through the side door.
Yeah. And because he is stripped of all the academic pressure, he feels so free and alive that he gives those fill-in classes his all. The energy he brings is so electric that the university politely asks the old teacher not to return, and they give Taras the permanent role.
Let's analyze his teaching philosophy here, because it's brilliant and deeply empathetic. Taras understands that the true secret to success on a social dance floor isn't showing off your own physical skills. It's about trust. He knows how to lead clearly and make his partner feel entirely safe.
He isn't a dance snob. He knows the partner is the star. If the partner shines, the couple looks great. He despises leads who try to execute all their fanciest, most complex moves while the partner has no idea what is going on, leaving them feeling foolish or off balance.
He actively dances down to the level of his student to build that essential trust. He never shows off at their expense. And he carries this into his social life, too. When he goes out to Latin clubs in Melbourne, he never just seeks out the highest level dancers to stroke his own ego.
Right. He's not trying to prove anything.
He's genuinely happy to adapt his level to ensure whoever he's dancing with feels fantastic, secure, and looks beautiful.
Because of this empathy, he becomes wildly popular. Women flock to him on the social floor because they know they'll be taken care of. Word spreads across the campus that there's this hot new Patrick Swayze-type dance teacher, and students just come pouring in. The club grows from a few dozen members to hundreds. It becomes the largest club in the entire university. He officially becomes the Patrick Swayze of Melbourne.
He's having the time of his life. And to celebrate the success of the club, he decides to throw a party.
He hosts this massive wild party. He invites everyone, his new dance students, his old friends from the architecture days, and his best friend, Paul Green, who flies in all the way from Sydney just for the celebrations.
And on that fateful night, amid the chaos and the music, the narrative shifts entirely.
A student brings a friend to the party, a stunning young medical student named Rebecca. Imagine you're standing on that dance floor. The music is loud. The room is packed with hundreds of people. Your best friend just flew across the country to be there. And then you see her. In a life that has been defined by scattered branches and detours, Tara suddenly finds complete and utter focus. This beautiful stranger is the love of his life. From that very first night, they become inseparable.
It is a totally cinematic moment. And with Rebecca by his side, life takes on a vibrant new energy. We enter chapter 8, where the scattered branches of his creative pursuits finally begin to prune themselves. The focus narrows.
Total Strictly Ballroom vibes here. He starts a new business called the Wolf Dance Club. He takes Rebecca on as his dance partner and trains her up from absolute scratch. He is combining his love for dance with his new love for her.
But professionally, the tectonic plates are shifting. Wolf Designs launches straight out of his living room. He adopts the slogan, "The Art in Architecture." As we discussed earlier, he cannot legally use the word architect yet. It's a brilliant workaround.
A great loophole.
He's telling clients, I am providing the aesthetic soul of the building while technically staying within the legal boundaries of a building designer. He still views himself first and foremost as an artist.
He also ventures into doing his own small property developments. And this is where his obsessiveness really shines through in the sources. He's out there on the building site, personally polishing hinges. He's demanding that the slots on every single screw head perfectly align in the exact same direction.
Which borders on a clinical obsession with detail.
Why does that matter, though? I mean, who aligns the slot on every single screw in a house? Is this just him being a control freak? Or is there a philosophical link here?
There's a profound link. Think about what this means for his actual career. He is translating the bodily discipline he learned in professional dance, where a millimeter shift in your posture dictates the success of a movement, into physical structures.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
That intense, uncompromising demand for precision was forged on the dance floor and applied directly to those early development sites. It's the exact foundation for why Wolf Architects specializes in extreme, high-end, bespoke work today. He trained his eye to see imperfections that others ignore.
Eventually, he realizes that doing his own developments isn't profitable enough, so he focuses purely on designing for others. Wolf Designs launches a small website, and they start attracting bigger and more complex commissions.
As the architectural design projects get larger and demand more of his creative energy, the dancing naturally begins to fade away.
He eventually retires from the dance floor completely. But think about the ultimate prizes he walks away with. He leaves that 15-year detour with his best friend and brother, Paul Green. And the grandest prize of all, his wife, Rebecca, and the foundation of the family they will build together.
It's a profound transition. The detour served its ultimate purpose. It wasn't a distraction. It was an incubation period.
I really want you to reflect for a second. How many times do we feel like a detour is just a massive waste of time? How often do we stress that we've fallen off the quote-unquote correct path laid out for us? Kadas proved that scrappy independence, playing the long game, and maintaining your creative spark isn't avoiding your destiny. It is actively gathering the very tools you need to build it.
Every odd job, every provocative dance competition, every late-night fax to secure a vintage Star Wars toy was shaping the resilience, the business acumen, and the artistry he would eventually pour into his true calling.
But here is where the story hits a massive wall. Approaching the age of 30, Taurus realizes he has to do the unthinkable. He wants his future daughter to be as proud of his career as she is of her doctor mother. To do that, he has to swallow his immense pride, admit defeat, and try to break back into the very rigid academic system he literally set fire to. How does a rebel return to the classroom? You'll have to join us for part 3 to find out.
I'll leave you with a final thought to mull over. We spend so much time trying to stay on the straight and narrow path that society lays out for us. We fear stepping off it, terrified of losing ground. But consider this. What if the specific genius you need to excel in your field can only be found by leaving it completely? What if your biggest distraction is actually your greatest curriculum?
I absolutely love that perspective. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We will see you back here for the final chapter of this incredible journey.